Welcome to the Israel Answers series, connecting Israel, the Bible, and you. Join Susan Michael as she explores timely issues and current events from a scriptural perspective to equip the Christian world with a balanced and biblical response. Be sure to subscribe for future episodes, which will ignite your faith and bring the Bible to life in your everyday world. Now, let's join Susan with your Israel Answers.
So we are here at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, where we have met with a lot of friends, made new friends, and I'm really excited to have with us for this interview two colleagues from an organization called Israel 365. They've been very busy this week. I've attended some of their events. So we want to learn more about their organization. We have today with us Rabbi Elie Michel and Rabbi Rami Goldberg. So welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So Rabbi Elie, tell us a little bit about Israel 365 and your role there.
Sure. So Israel 365 is dedicated to building bridges and relationships, real true friendships between Jews and Christians. And together, we then work together to support Israel and the land of Israel, the people of Israel, all in the name of the God of Israel. And it all centers around the Hebrew Bible, because that is the Bible that we share in common. I think as Dennis Prager said, there's only, in the history of the world, there are only two religions that share a holy book. Yes. And that's Jews and Christians, and that's the Hebrew Bible. And
yes.
So with mutual respect and really beautiful friendship. Yeah. So we've been building friendships now for over a decade, and we've been able to accomplish unbelievable
Wonderful.
Things together.
Wonderful. Rabbi Rami?
Yeah. So I'm the Director of Strategic Relations. I actually started more recently with Israel 365, only about 6 months ago. And I actually come from industry and bringing my know-how and my knowledge to helping develop a lot of the relationships and taking things to the next level, because we have a lot of projects, as you mentioned.
Yes.
And that we need to take it really to the next level. So that's part of what I'm doing.
So here. I'm assuming you met a lot of new partners this week.
Yes.
Made a lot of contacts. So tell us a little bit about what activities you had here this week.
Yeah. So we had two major events. One was a war room, and where, you know, obviously since the events of the massacre of October 7th, it's been a challenging time in Israel, and really to give people a flavor of that, we brought in a number of hostage families, we brought in a number of soldiers to explain really what's going on the ground, and that was very well received. We had several hundred people in small groups come through, so they can really, really experience a very emotional event. And then we had our Keep God's Land launch event, which I want to turn that over to Rabbi Elie, who's one of the brainchilds behind that.
Sure. So the Keep God's Land movement is not—it's not just Israel 365. We're simply a part of it, but it's really an amazing new movement of Jews and Christians united together to stand for the state of Israel's right to the entire land of Israel. And it's kind of unbelievable. We've been planning this for many months because, you know, I live in Judea. I'm a settler, so I'm an obstacle to peace. Obviously, you see that I'm a very dangerous person. My wife and my teenage daughters, we're all very, you know, very dangerous. So this is very personal for us. But we've been planning this for many months, but it could not have been launched at a more appropriate time. You know, this week, President Biden and his administration have been pushing the idea of a Palestinian state unilaterally without Israel giving the okay, and without Israel working together in partnership with these people. And literally the day before our event, the Knesset voted overwhelmingly rejecting that. And so here we were on, you know, yesterday with Ambassador David Friedman and with Michelle Bachmann, who are some of the heads of this movement. You know, and us behind the scenes, you know, kind of helping push this forward. It's really, it was amazing thing to see this. And when we came out very, very strongly, not only rejecting the two-state delusion, which is what we like to call it, but also putting forward Ambassador Friedman's plan for lasting peace in the Middle East. So it was really a historic day yesterday, and hopefully it's only up from here.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit more. I love that you called it the two-state delusion. It was after 30 years of trying to enforce this two-state vision, and it has just failed for 30 years, it's time that they realize it is a delusion. It's not a workable plan. And this Gaza situation is proof of that. That on October 6th, there was a ceasefire. There was, you know, this dream of a Palestinian state. And look what came out of it. Israel withdrew from Gaza. They withdrew all Jewish communities out of Gaza back in 2005, turned it over to the Palestinians. They could have had a beautiful, beautiful state there and life on the Mediterranean. Wouldn't we all, you know, love to have that? And they just completely threw it away, all because of their obsession in annihilating the Jewish people and wiping Israel off the map. So it is time that we recognize this two-state solution is a delusion. And so tell us just a little bit more. Yesterday at your forum, David Friedman, the former ambassador of the United States to Israel, the one who moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, did present a plan. Can you, would one of you like to explain just a little bit what that plan is?
Sure. It's not rocket science. I think Dave, that's what David said yesterday. It's simple, it's straightforward, and we think that it can work. The Arabs have to give up on this notion of sovereignty, that they can somehow have their own state in the very heart of Israel's biblical lands. It simply cannot be. It's over. They had their 19-year experiment, but as Michelle Bachmann said yesterday, the Oslo Accords, about 30 years ago, they were a cruel, sick joke, is what came out of it, right? Just a lot of dead Jews, unfortunately, tragically. So that's over. So what does that mean? It means that Israel has to retain absolute control in terms of security over all of these lands, Judea and Samaria and Gaza as well. Absolute security control. It also means that it's simply not possible demographically for these millions of Arabs. We don't know exactly how many there are in Gaza and Judea and Samaria. They inflate the numbers. But there still are some millions of people, but somewhere between 3 and 4 million Arabs. It's not possible for them to be full citizens, because if they would vote, that would destroy the state of Israel, right? These are people who are radicalized. I think 83% of the Arabs in Judea and Samaria fully support the slaughter and massacre of October 7th. These are people who live a few hundred yards from my house.
Yeah.
So obviously making them citizens and voting citizens is not possible. On the other hand, giving them, you know, some sort of local governmental control to some degree is great. You know, let them have, and we want them to do well financially, right? But they have to, we've got to find a way. And this is something also that the prime minister has been talking about, to de-radicalize them. So it can only come through complete defeat of the terrorists, right? And then only through that complete defeat, just as we did to the Nazis and to the Japanese, only from complete and utter defeat will they then come out of this sick anti-Semitic, you know, radicalism. So if we could completely defeat them, right, and then we're on top of their schools, and we're in charge, and we eliminate all the people who don't want to play nicely, right? Let's kill them before they kill us. That's it. That's fight like David. That can lead over time to peace. It's not exciting, right? This is not a plan that's going to happen all at once and with a big signing, right? It's going to take time, but I think it's the only way.
But it's based on a precedent here in the United States, right? Isn't this based on like a situation we have with Puerto Rico? Am I not right?
Yeah, you said Puerto Rico and Guam. Like, everyone talks about, oh, why aren't you talking about apartheid, right? Okay, because South Africa is the place that, you know, they're doing such a fantastic job with their country, and, you know, talking about how this will be an apartheid. But the United States has many places where you can't vote, and they live very well. The Puerto Ricans are not crying, give us our own state, let's secede from the Union. Guam is the same thing. The level of that they're living has been raised. I think if you take a look at the Palestinian, the Israeli Arab cities that have chosen to come under Israeli rule, they have risen up and they have become members of society, and they've been contributing members of society. In addition, I think with Ambassador Friedman's plan, you'll see additional infrastructure projects throughout Judea and Samaria. I mean, I have my son learns in a school in Beit El, in Bethel, and there's one highway going back and forth. I mean, it could take an hour, what should be a 15-minute drive, because we have not invested the proper infrastructure there, because there's always this, like, where are we? And what Ambassador Freeman's plan would allow for is for tremendous investment, which will benefit the Jews and the Arabs to have a better life.
And it will produce peace because, number one, Israel will control the building of the infrastructure. So no more will billions of dollars be given for infrastructure that goes to building terror tunnels underground, right? Secondly, Israel will control the curriculum in the schools, or will make sure that maybe the UN agency or somebody controls the curriculum.
We've already seen the UN agency.
Well, not that agency. Right. We're hoping that agency is seeing its final days. But true curriculum that teaches and prepares the young Palestinians for peace, to live in peace.
Yeah, but there are a few preconditions. First and foremost, they have to be utterly defeated. Until they're utterly defeated, they won't accept, right, that their ideology is broken and evil.
Right.
That's number one. And number two, we have to recognize there will always be people who can't accept this and refuse to accept this. And we have to be prepared to say, well, then leave.
Yes.
Right? Emigration is a beautiful thing. There's no problem with emigration. It's not inhumane. There are 22 other Arab countries that are largely empty, and they can go there. We'd be delighted for them to go there. So if they're not willing to accept Israeli sovereignty, if they're not willing to be full-on, proper, healthy citizens, essentially, of the state of Israel, then get out.
Well, I want to come back to now this David Friedman plan, because the United States cannot oppose it if we've got the same situation with Guam and Puerto Rico, right? Wouldn't we be totally hypocritical?
Well, I want to distinguish between the United States and the current administration.
Okay.
Right? But to be very careful, but, you know, it's the United States is still a majority pro-Israel country.
Absolutely.
And this nation is the great light for the world. But I, frankly, at this point, the Biden administration is so desperate to try to win re-election that they're willing to do anything and everything to simply win Michigan and to make the Arab community of Dearborn, yeah, Michigan, happy. I mean, that's what it comes down to. So whatever you were saying, it makes sense, but I don't think they're going to be convinced. They're desperate, and all they care about is being reelected at this point.
Yes. And I want to ask you, Rabbi, I understand that you lost a friend or a neighbor because of the sorry policies coming out of the Biden administration. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah. So we have in my community is the Early family. And their son Binyamin, who's 22, who's my kind of a role model for my kids. My oldest is 18 years old, and so this is kind of his, you know, one of the kids that he looks up to in the community. And what happened is we're going hand to hand, house by house combat, and rather than kind of carpet bombing. You know, obviously, once we've given all the warnings and people have moved out of the way and done everything that we need to do morally to make sure that we're fighting a humane battle, we take that extra step. And this young hero, stepped into a house and was shot by a terrorist rather than just blowing the whole thing up. And so that was all because the whole world looks at us and like, oh, you're, you know, genocide against the Palestinians, when nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, take a look at every American war, take a look at every war around the world. Tens of thousands of people in a blink of an eye are wiped off the face of the earth. Whereas we send flyers, we move people down, we move them out of safety, we move them to safety, and do our best to in the best possible way. And so this was one of the tragic deaths, and unfortunately there was many more that have happened simply because we're choosing to fight a battle with one hand tied behind our back.
Yes, and I believe that's another example of our American hypocrisy. And as I agree with you, I'm talking about the current administration, not the American people, because look at World War II. And my father was a World War II vet. He was on the front lines of the infantry all the way from Normandy to Czechoslovakia. And he was one of the finest human beings you'll ever know. He hated killing. He hated, you know, but they had to almost destroy whole cities to bring down that evil regime. And it's very hypocritical of us to tell Israel that you cannot go in with full force and bring defeat quickly and get those hostages out. And so I just wanted you to share that story because we're dealing with human lives here. And this administration is playing politics while there's human lives that are suffering. So I want to go back to our initial conversation before we end our time today about Jewish-Christian relations. I love what you're doing. We, as the ICEJ, of course, have been involved in pioneering that relationship for 43 years now. And because I'm so old and I've been around since the beginning, I've seen waves of development in Jewish-Christian relations. It's been so fulfilling to see that happen. But I literally remember what it was like walking the streets of Jerusalem in the early 80s. The ICJ was just forming. I was a very young student at the time. But the skepticism that I would reach, like, why are you here? And then I remember about 10 years later, similar situations, and it's like, oh, you're here for the Feast of Tabernacles, welcome. And it was just like a complete sea change. Now, that's in Jerusalem where we were based, and largely with the English-speaking Israeli, you know, population that knew about us. But here in the United States then, we weren't enjoying that growth in the relationship. And in the 90s, we did a lot of events around the country, and we would reach out to the local Jewish community, and we were always, you know, just held back, and they wouldn't participate. And sometimes they write an article against us right after we were in the city, and it's like, and the Israeli diplomats would go to the Jewish community and say, what are you doing? These are our friends. You know, we work with them in Israel. But it all changed almost overnight in 2000. And that was during the Second Intifada. The bus bombings taking place in Israel shut down all tourism. And here comes the Feast of Tabernacles. We had thousands of Christians show up. And some of them went down and rode the city buses in solidarity with the people of Israel. And it really got the attention of the Jewish community in America. And since then, we've seen it growing here. But we had a phenomenal development in the fall after the October 7th attack. The Jewish community has really been shocked here in America, I'm speaking of, that all of these liberal groups that they befriended and stood up for turned against them. But here were the Christians. And so we had a phenomenal development where in November we were approached by some rabbinical networks, said, we want to come together in Washington, D.C. We want to do something together. We did, long story short, by the end of January, we did an advocacy day on Capitol Hill. Rabbis and pastors, and some of us that were not rabbis or pastors, but Christian and Jewish leaders. And we had 30 different appointments on the Hill that day. And it was so exciting to see this. And the rabbis were so appreciative. And you felt like they were kind of like looking around. And then after we go in and meet with a member of Congress and the Christian would speak up, and you could just see the Jewish response of this, okay, we're with friends.
Yeah. Well, it's been a long journey, as you said, and this is really part of the redemptive process, right? The reconciliation of Jews and Christians over the last 50 and 100 years, I mean, especially since the founding of the State of Israel. And it has its ups and downs, right? I think that the sages have a saying that, you know, redemption is like a gazelle. Sometimes you see it, then it hides its face, then you don't see it, it disappears, times get a little tough, then you see it again and you have an incredible moment, and It's not like it's a straight line.
Right.
And so we've had our ups and downs, and that comes for a few different reasons, both from both sides, actually. Because the Jewish community in America in particular, not living in Israel, meaning Jews in America are a minority. They're always on the defensive and always afraid and always nervous. Which is why so many of the Jews who are involved in Jewish-Christian relations actually live in Israel. Because in Israel, we're in our natural habitat.
Yes.
And we're comfortable and we feel confident. And so it's much easier to reach out, even though we're thousands of miles away, whereas the Jews in your backyard in America are often too nervous and too scared. So they need to overcome that. I just spoke this past Shabbat in New Jersey. I spoke to many, many, many Jews there. I mean, this is what we spoke about. And I think there's really a newfound openness, as you mentioned, you know, after October 7th, when we realize how alone we are, all these people that they somehow thought were friends, were not really friends, right? So there's definitely an openness, and I think that's an incredible silver lining from this horrible time. At the same time, right, the other major challenge, and this is both in Israel and America, is the whole question of evangelizing to Jews. And that, you know, even if it's not everyone who's doing that, and there are only some who do that, but, you know, Jews who don't know the difference, that, you know, Christians are all different. Right? There's 2.2 billion Christians in the world. Not everybody's the same, just like Jews are different from each other, right? Jews need to learn and to distinguish. But because there are, you know, there are Christians out there that are continuing to try to convert them and change them, it makes it difficult. They get nervous and they're afraid, understandably so. And so we really need an effort from both sides. You know, I think as many Christians have to understand, they don't need to put aside their beliefs. I always tell Christians, you can pray for me to believe in Jesus one day. That's totally fine. That's exciting. I'm honored. You know, I believe what I believe, and you believe what you believe, and I think that's wonderful. And you should pray for me. That's wonderful. But when it comes to this healing, this brokenness for 1900 years, we've got to learn that when we're with each other in person, you know, make us jealous, as Paul said, right? You know, just be so wonderful and so kind and so loving as you have been, as so many other Christians have been to me. Like, you know, make us jealous. That's the way to share your beliefs. And if we can do that, I think the Jewish community will let its guard down a little bit, and we'll see new levels of friendship that we have never seen before. I got a taste of this in Dallas a few days after October 7th. I left my wife and kids in a bomb shelter. And I flew into Dallas, and it was a revolutionary moment. There were 800-900 Orthodox Jews who had never done something like this before. They got together with also about 800-900 Christians in the first major Jewish Christian rally that ever happened in the state of Texas. I mean, that was after October 7th, and it was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful. So the potential here is extraordinary, but both sides have to, you know, slowly overcome.
Well, I'm very appreciative of Israel 365 and for what you're doing. I feel like we now have a counterpart. You know, many times we were working from the Christian perspective to build a relationship, but now we have a counterpart. So anyway, we can partner together, work together. We'd be very happy to. And so thank you for taking time to speak to our audience today. It's really a great opportunity for them to hear your heart and to get a taste of this new relationship that God is doing. So thank you both very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Out of Zion with Susan Michael. Be sure to subscribe to Out of Zion now on Apple Podcasts, cpnshows.com, YouTube, or wherever you like to listen and learn. Out of Zion with Susan Michael is a production of ICEJ USA, all rights reserved.